sorry that I did you wrong. Look up, darling. Let me kiss you.
Just one. On our next segment coming up, we cover a very tender subject because of an article that was in the Baltimore City paper about one of their employees who was arrested for sexual assault of a child. There are some graphic descriptions in this conversation, so I want to warn you now for that. Listener discretion is advised for the conversation coming up. Before I bring that to you, I wanted to let you know, if you don't want your kids listening, that you should move them out of the room or turn the radio off. Don't go away. Welcome, everybody. We are about to have another conversation here on the Mark Steiner Show today, and this one's a very tough one. It's something that came out of the city paper, and to say here right up front, the Baltimore City paper and the Mark Steiner Show, the Center for Emerging Media, have a relationship. And when my program first started 21 years ago, we had an intense relationship with the paper, and we've reignited that relationship with the city paper, and it means a great deal to us. I consider both Evan Serpik and Van Smith friends, people who I've worked with in the past many times, and I just want to lay that out. I think that's important for us to know as we begin this conversation. And there was an article in last week's city paper, which was entitled "CP Photographer Accused of Raping His Daughter," which I actually, honestly, since I was reading some other things in that paper, I didn't read this article, and then I read it after the fact. When one of our guests, Adam Rosenberg, who's executive director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, wrote a letter about this piece. And so he's been having conversations with the city paper, and I called Baynard Woods, who we work with a great deal at the paper, senior editor, and saying, look, I think we have to do something and talk about this issue on the air, and both as terms of journalism and ethics and the paper and the reporting and how this works and our continuing coverage of sexual abuse in this program, they will always do. So we are joined here now by Van Smith, who is the senior staff writer for the Baltimore City Paper, who wrote the piece. Evan Serpik is with us. He's the editor-in-chief for the Baltimore City Paper. Adam Rosenberg, as I said earlier, is in studio with me. He's executive director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, who wrote the letter that the City Paper published in their newspaper. And Wendy Murphy joins us. She's an adjunct professor at the New England Law, Boston, where she has taught a seminar on sexual violence for more than 10 years and was founder and director of the Victim Advocacy and Research Group, a volunteer legal advocacy organization that has provided free legal services to victims and other third parties in the criminal justice system since 1992. And welcome to have you all. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to be here.
So I'm almost trying to figure out where to begin this conversation. So let me just start here. So to say that there was an article written, as I said, about a city paper photographer who's been accused of raping his young daughter. That was in the city paper. And no other media really has covered this. But Evan, you all decided to cover it. Why don't we start there? Why don't we start with why you decided to cover this?
Well, we thought it was an important story for us to cover. We've known Ryan Stevenson is the name of the photographer, and we've known him for a long time. It was an important case, and we also didn't want it to look as if we were ignoring the case because of our relationship with Ryan Stevenson. So we felt like it was important to report it fully, explain the situation, the charges, and treat it like we would any other case that we feel like is important. Ryan is not only a longtime photographer for City Paper, but for The Sun, for The New York Times, for lots of other publications. He's a very prominent guy in sort of local media circles. We thought it was an important story to cover.
And I'll say that Van Smith is a longtime investigative reporter for the City Paper. For 20 years, Van? More?
Probably more, I guess, at this point.
So then you wrote this letter to the editor, Adam. And let's talk about what spurred you on to write this letter and what was it that offended you so much about the article?
When the and my staff brought the article to my attention first, they had seen it, and what I guess raised our collective concern, Mark and Evan and Van, was that we think it went too far, and that even as we started the segment, Mark, we referred to that, you know, photographer's accused of raping his daughter, and the mere act of even saying who the victim is in this, I think goes to identify who that person is. And could this article have been written differently so that we didn't – identification of the child isn't just about leaving her name out of it, but about removing enough identifying information so that the guts of the case can still get out there, the spirit of it, without necessarily letting people know who it is. And could we have referred to her as just, you know, accused of raping child, accused of raping 14-year-old, accused of raping child who lived in household, without specifically going to the point where suddenly anybody reading it, you know, has a general idea who it is. And then, and Evan and Van and I have talked about this, you know, the article perhaps unintentionally goes the next step further by identifying the child's mother, so that even though the effort was made perhaps to specify which child it was, by going to the point of identifying the mother of the child and the father of the child, anybody reading the article knows who the kid is. And at that point, in our opinion, and we're not journalists, I mean, we're lawyers and social workers and child advocates, we felt that went over the line of what perhaps are journalistic ethics, that we identified a child at that point. And as the article goes on, there are just details that perhaps weren't necessary to be in there, rather graphic depictions of what this rape was. And when me and my staff and my board members, we've all read other articles when they cover this very delicate subject, there's an effort made perhaps to minimize the harm and to show a little bit of perhaps good taste, which is what's written in the Society of Professional Journalists. So it doesn't really quite go over the description of feeling the penis there. And that's a bit much. And so it came to, so I think we concluded a couple things. One, it identified the child. Two, it went too far, making it a very graphic depiction. And three, we fear it could have a chilling effect on other people who read this, to say that they're coming forward with their deep, dark secret, saying something. And then suddenly it could appear in the paper. And that's what really concerned us.
So before we turn to Wendy Murphy, Van and Evan, so what about that critique? I mean, could this article have been written without her name, without the mother's name, without the graphic descriptions? I know they were in the court record, but most people don't spend the time going through court records. They just read the article and go away or think about it. Do you think that in retrospect that was over the top?
Well, her name wasn't in it, for one thing, even though it is in the...
The mother's name's in the article.
The victim's name, the alleged victim's name, was in the article. The mother's name is in, and I don't know if Van want to explain, but as we talked to Adam about, the reason we included the mother's name was because Mr. Stevenson has another daughter of about the same age by a different mother, and so we were concerned about that people would misidentify her as the victim, and so that was why the decision was made to include the mother's name. As far as the graphic descriptions, as you know, we talked to Adam about when we spoke on the phone earlier. Part of that is the way we approach stories of sexual abuse, which we take very seriously and handle carefully, is that we don't want to gloss over the real horror of these charges and make clear what was happening. It's not as if, Mr. Stevenson is someone we're treating with any kind of kid gloves. We make it very clear what the charges are against him. We felt like that was really important to do. I don't know if, Van, if you want to talk at all about your decisions and reporting.
Right. Well, the true nature of the allegations allow society to be confronted with what happens in these things. And Adam, when we spoke on the phone, I thought you would come around and agree that was a legitimate motivation for describing what the actual allegations are, as opposed to just the charges.
No, I think I had, I certainly listened, and I guess I understood where you were coming from, but I didn't necessarily agree that it was the right place to be coming from. And if that wasn't clear when we spoke, my apologies, and hoping to have that chance to really sit and, talk one-on-one on that. So there was an article in last Friday's Sun about a doctor who was charged with raping a patient. And the article is a long article, but it doesn't go into the graphic depiction as to how the rape was and the details from the rape and lifting direct passages from the charging documents there. And when I spoke with you guys on the phone, and I still give you this credit, it's important to cover these stories. And you are not in an easy position to be able to cover the stories. But I think part of the dialogue, which I relish being able to have, is how can we cover these stories and how can we let society know, as you appropriately point out, that these are horrible crimes and we need to be paying attention to them.
And Wendy, let me bring you into the conversation here, and I appreciate you taking the time with us today. So you've read the article.
Yep.
And you've seen the back and forth between the letters to the editor and the article.
Yep.
So give us your perspective before I come in with my own questions. I just wanted to let you all lay it out on the table first.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad I'm I'm third or fourth here because I do hear both sides, and it's not an easy issue to resolve as if there's a simple answer or a correct side, because I do think that whatever the policy, there's a risk of harm. The question is, you know, are we too far in one direction or the other? I've been a child abuse and sex crimes prosecutor. I've taught with the Poynter Institute with regard to reporting policies around these issues. I think they even have a curriculum up at their website that I wrote. I'm not sure if it's still there. But the point is that it's not been a topic that's gotten much attention and perhaps has gotten attention it needs in the recent past, which is why it's so important to have this conversation. So let me say a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is, I thought the article was generally excellent, and I loved that it was as clear as it was about what happened. In fact, if anything, I would have probably wanted to know a little bit more of what it meant by many instances. You know, was it once a week? Was it once a month? I don't need to know exactly, you know, in a pornographic sense, what part of the penis went into which part of the vagina or the mouth or whatever, but I did want to know what was meant by many, and here's why. When we, the public, hold the criminal justice system accountable in this case, and let's say, for example, at the end of the prosecution, there's some kind of meager punishment, it's going to be very difficult for those of us reading the story to know whether it's meager or adequate if we don't have a sense of exactly how many times it happened, and the context matters. Not in terms of raw numbers, but was it every time she went on a visitation, you know, and so forth. So I thought there could have been even more. Now, I've been...
But Wendy, I got to interrupt you.
Let her finish her thought.
Sure.
But let me... I just want to make a few points and just respond to a lot of what you guys have said first. I've written many, many letters to the editor over the years complaining about what I call weasel words or meaningless terms such as molestation and sexual abuse, because it really tells us nothing about what happened, and especially with child sex abuse cases, we can't tell whether what happened was a simple hand pat on the rear end or something far more serious. And words like rape take us instantly to the severity of the incident, and that's critically important. As hard as it is to accept, one of the things we need to do in this country is get comfortable with our discomfort around this topic, and that means being forced, frankly, being forced to be uncomfortable, because mm-hmm. that's what's going to give us the capacity as human beings to take in the reality of the facts. And because it's so easy to block it out when it's horrible, you know, making something horrible invisible makes it a lot harder for the public to become connected to the story with regard to really having an appreciation for what the victim has gone through. Now, let me just say very quickly, I do appreciate that it's hard to justify naming a child victim because a child is too young to make the decision. I always defer to the victim. Some victims want to be named, some don't. It's hard for a child to make that decision. So, you know, naming the child's parents by definition names the child. I would like to think we live in a world where we can avoid that as much as possible. But Elizabeth Smart, remember, she went missing and we all knew everything about her. And we only found out after we knew who she was that she was, in fact, repeatedly raped. There was no way to undo that knowledge. And she's actually, you know, enjoying on some level, I don't want to overstate the word enjoy, but, you know, she's really enjoying her role as a spokesperson where she's empowering young people to speak out. In other words, it's not always shameful. So even as we sit here and say it's too bad that we know who this child is that terrible, that's really the child's choice. And just like Elizabeth Smart is not feeling terrible that she's known for having been a victim of multiple rapes, you know, we can't just decide for this child that she's devastated by it. That may not end up true, and she may really appreciate that there is as much public oversight to what happened to her because now she feels protected. And, you know, we can choose to reward her and celebrate her and make her feel heroic instead of shamed by what happened to her, and that's our problem, that we haven't done that well enough.
And I have some very specific questions here about how these kind of things proceed, but you were objecting to what?
Well, having been I'm a former sex crimes prosecutor myself, and that while I agree with you that it's important for the public to see what happens with these cases, you know, it's important for the public to see what happens with these cases and that people get held accountable. Unfortunately, when it comes time for trial, you know, there are difficult decisions to be made, and that, you know, to some degree, it's not really for the public to have to, I guess, learn about the number of instances that a rape may have occurred in the past, simply because, you know, in this case, you know, you're only tried for one instance, so you're not tried for prior bad acts. He's charged with one count of rape here. And that's what the trial is going to be on. That's what the sentence is going to be on. And it may be because of a myriad of reasons that she may not have had the specificity to be able to say it, or when the case ends up being resolved, it pleads out because she doesn't want to testify. He wants to be done with the case. I mean, there's multiple reasons that the number, you know, the volume of detail in an early stage of a case being reported doesn't necessarily equate to, a fair measure as to what happens in the sentence at the end.
That was Adam Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. You also heard Van Smith, Senior Staff Writer for the Baltimore City Paper, Evan Serpik, Editor of the City Paper, and Wendy Murphy, Adjunct Professor of the New England Law, Boston, where she's taught a seminar on sexual violence for more than 10 years. She's also Founder and Director of the Victim Advocacy and Research Group. We're going to take a very short break. Don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of this really important conversation. And playing under me right now, the great Mel Torme, Yesterday When I Was Young. Remember him, he passed away on this day. Stay with us, we'll be right back. See a different shine yesterday. This is Mark Steiner, and that is Ronnie Dyson, Close to You. He was born on this day in 1950, so we hear his music on this day. Reminding you, listen to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And support for WEAA is provided by Six Flags. And today, you're about to hear the second half of the conversation we started in the last half an hour. We're talking about an article in the May 14th issue of the Baltimore City Paper about accusations of child sexual assault against a City Paper contributing photographer. The article caused a stir among many people in the advocacy community, who thought it went way too far in its description of sexual assault of a minor. They were also upset, though it didn't name the alleged survivor, it strongly suggested who that person was. So we're joined by Adam Rosenberg, Chief Critic and Executive Director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, Van Smith, Senior Staff Writer for the Baltimore City Paper, author of the article, and Evan Serpik, Editor of the City Paper, and Wendy Murphy, who is Adjunct Professor of the New England Law, Boston, where she has taught a seminar on sexual violence for more than 10 years. She's also Founder and Director of the Victim Advocacy and Research Group. And just to be clear, the Mark Steiner Show and the Center for Emerging Media have had a long-standing relationship with the Baltimore City Paper, which is exactly why we're doing this story, for total transparency and to put things out there that have to be put out there. Also, this conversation includes some very graphic descriptions of child sexual assault. So we think so listener discretion is advised. If you don't want your children hearing this or you don't want to hear it, please turn off the radio for just a bit, and let's continue our conversation from last half hour. So let me ask this is very tough. I mean, the question is always very tough because I think that our society is still on the edges of addressing and dealing with sexual abuse and young people, and I think that we have not tackled it head on in many ways. We act like it's abhorrent and we hate it, but we really have tackled it head on. So let me think back some of the issues that really came up with this. I mean, was the question, and let me just go right to Evan and Van first on this, and you all can comment as well. Could the article have been written without using the mother's name or directly saying that who it was or alluding to it? It could have been said that Ryan Stevenson was accused of of sexual assault or rape of someone in his family, in his familial world or whatever, to distance us from the possibility of identifying the child in case or her seeing being identified and what that potential might have for making other children afraid to come forward.
I don't understand the potential for other children being afraid to come forward. If you've been victimized and you bring the information to the authorities, if they follow through with charges, you're always going to be at risk of having that information known publicly. It's a public proceeding in a court, and so the decision over whether or not to go forward has nothing to do with press coverage. It has more to do with, you know what, this is on the permanent record of my life. And so the decision really is comes much before that, and before any possibility of press coverage.
But there's a lot more people who read your paper than will watch it in court. And it's in the public record in court, but it's certainly not like there's going to be the thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who potentially can see this and find out who this kid is the next day in school.
Yeah, finding this victim is something I have not been able to do based on the information that's in the article.
Can I just chime in here? Why are we so quick to say finding out who this child is would be terrible for her? It's just the wrong-headed reaction, because it's kind of a bootstrapping of what we know is problematic in these cases, which is that victims on average don't like to report or don't come forward because they're afraid of being judged and shamed. They're not afraid of justice. That's what they want. So it's all about our response more than it is about, the horrors of having access to justice. I just have to turn that on its head. And let me also say that, when you protect, especially in an incest case, when you protect the identity of the victim by shielding the identity of the perpetrator, you're really disproportionately hiding a certain type of violence against children and giving preferential treatment to familial violence compared to non-familial violence. And if anything, the incest taboo really needs a kick in the rear end. And to some extent, I think the cost of that will be forced disclosure of the identities of children. But let me tell you something, having done this work for a long time, children being abused behind closed doors would rather be known as a victim of rape behind closed doors than be raped with impunity behind closed doors.
But what about the? I think this is an interesting question to wrestle with here, because this is, I mean, clearly a cutting point here. I think, especially at this moment between Adam and Wendy, over what's acceptable when it comes to a minor, and what we think is acceptable as adults when it comes to a minor, as parents when it comes to a minor, and how much you want out there for somebody who doesn't have that kind of control. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, so you can prosecute somebody for a horrendous crime of incest and sexually assaulting a child. But I still don't understand, Wendy, what you're saying about the name or even getting
I'm
close
saying,
to
why,
the name.
Why do we want to give the control over whether the perpetrator is identified by burdening the child with the responsibility of not wanting to be identified? In other words, this policy of not identifying the perpetrator because it necessarily identifies the child when the child is the perpetrator.
I don't think we're saying not identifying the perpetrator. I think we're saying not identifying the victim's mother.
What I'm talking about is the broader policy. We have this policy that we have to understand. By not identifying a child victim in an incest situation and going out of our way not to identify that child at all, we are necessarily protecting the offender in ways that we don't do when the offender is not the parent of the child. And we have to understand how dangerous that is to the vast majority of children who are abused behind the closed doors of their own homes.
But I think you're throwing a juxtaposition in there, Wendy, that in one sense you're saying that, you know, we want to be able to give the child perhaps the right to come forward and to be public about it, as Elizabeth Smart has done. And having met her, I'm not sure she's really enjoying this, but to come forward and to say what she's done. But on the other side, where, you know, should the city paper have contacted the child or the child's mother to ask them for permission to write this story and to identify her as daughter versus child?
No, because to ask
So we're making the decision for her.
Well, right, but what I'm saying is, if you burden the child and not the public official or the responsible journalist with the duty to do the right thing, notwithstanding what the child might want, I'm not saying the child shouldn't have a voice. What I'm saying is, you can't keep indulging the underlying problem, which is that there are lots of pressures on children who are abused in their own homes. There are lots of pressures on them to not tell, and if they do tell, to not tell. If they do report it to somebody, you know, then to not be identified, and it really creates a shield of secrecy, which is not only the antithesis of what journalism is supposed to be, but is ultimately more harmful than helpful if the goal is to shine a light on the behavior behind closed doors. This is my point. I'm not saying all children should bear the cost of what I think the right public policy decision is. I'm saying we've blindly indulged the wrong policy to the great detriment of children as a class for an awful long time.
But now, but Evan, let me ask a question. When a paper reports on a rape, you don't put the woman's name in there, right? If it's a woman.
I think typically not. Similarly, we didn't include the victim here either in her name. And I explained sort of why we included the mother's name, which was a carefully considered point, and like I said, was to be careful not to identify someone who was uninvolved in the case, which was the decision we came down with.
I mean, so, but in the case of an adult, we don't put the name of the victim out there, the rape victim.
Well, unless they want it.
Unless they want it.
Right.
Right.
And can I just say one quick thing about that? Because the reason we don't put the name of victims out there is not simply it's so shameful. Because when you keep the secrecy around the shame, it's a self-perpetuating cycle that the shame is worthy and so forth. So I understand that argument. It's because sexual violence victims endure uniquely private harm that robbery victims don't endure. They get torn vaginas. They get HIV/AIDS. They become pregnant. They have abortions. Those things are not shameful. They're private.
And to build on that, they also get uniquely scrutinized. You know, refer to someone as an alleged robbery victim. They're a victim of robbery.
That problem, and you're right, that problem is not fixed by more secrecy. It is, in fact, indulged by more secrecy. So we have to be careful not to go too far in either direction to recognize the unique privacy violations that victims endure so that we don't say to every victim, if you dare seek justice, the entire world will know that you had an abortion and got AIDS, right? We don't want to burden anybody with that responsibility. And because of the unique problems that sexual assault victims endure, we honor that by not revealing them, but the far other extreme is knee-jerk secrecy, where we don't tell what happened, we don't reveal the perpetrator's name because we're afraid somebody might figure out who the victim is. These are public proceedings anyway. If I want to walk into a courtroom and I happen to have the capacity to bring 4 million people with me, I can watch this case unfold. I can see who the victim is. I can hear the lurid details. The goal of newspapers is to provide as much of that value as they can, because we're talking about the criminal justice system, which the public is probably preeminently most interested in hearing and seeing and watching. It is the public's most important, right to see this stuff unfold, and we don't get to see it.
But when you look at the code of journalistic ethics, they specifically talk about minimizing harm, and they say show compassion for those who may be affected adversely by news coverage and use special sensitivity when dealing with children, as a subject there. Be sensitive when seeking or using interviews or photographs of those affected by tragedy or grief, and recognizing that gathering or reporting information may cause harm and discomfort.
This was sensitive. I think this article was sensitive, because it was respectful of this child's suffering.
Do you think then that I guess, will cases like this cause a chilling effect for prosecutors then? Because that...
I don't think so. There's no data to suggest that. As I said, the studies that are out there say over and over again, what victims fear is not being known, but being disbelieved and disrespected.
Absolutely, but when you read the comments even on this article now, that you know, suddenly this becomes an issue of custody, and that, you know, the attention's immediately diverted from the fact that, you know, here's an adult allegedly charged with raping his daughter, and then when you read through the comments even on the paper page, it becomes about, you know, people are commenting on the victim's mother, people are commenting on, you know, custody, and they're diverting that, and you know, the true horror of it is immediately diverted.
Well, that's true. Look, anybody who participates in the criminal justice system, in a sense, has some exposure that they will be judged harshly. That's the nature of the game. But we don't want to falsely imply that the system is uniquely punitive toward women and children, because we've been doing that for so long that they disproportionately do not seek access to justice. And as a result, you're far more likely to go to jail if you steal someone's wallet than if you rape and abuse and beat the hell out of a woman or child's body. That is unacceptable.
So coming back to the article, it's interesting. I'm glad the two of you on here, because you're both in the same world, and I appreciate Evan and Van willing to be part of this as well, because it was very tough, the back and forth between the letters to the editor and the article and what this has ensued, and the emails we've gotten, the phone calls I've gotten from people saying, you know, are you going to talk about this? And, of course, we are talking about it. One of the things about the piece, and this is just a journalistic question I just want to ask, to come up in one of the letters, Van, was when Stevenson's lawyer, who I know, said that this is how many percentage of cases like this with people are actually lying and not telling the truth, and his facts were kind of backwards in terms of the numbers. Would it be better to would have been good to kind of put another sentence in there saying, but other people say this, that the numbers actually say something different?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Can I respond to that? Because that was the one thing I thought was terrible about the article.
Well, I was going.
Not that.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to see what Van had to say. And I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's cool. Van.
So I appreciated being able to get the defense attorney to comment. At all, because they usually are not able to get one. They're not willing to. And what he said was a blanket statement that did not quantify anything. It just said that this happened, that false accusations do happen. And I went and started and spent a good hour or two trying to look up the literature that I could online, and I found that the data on this rate of false accusations of rape goes anywhere, you know, there's orders of magnitude in separating the two ends of the spectrum on how often this happens. My feeling was that if I was to try to address that issue, then it's really not part of what the story's about.
Yeah, all he actually says, I'm reading the quote, is after explaining Mr. Stevenson has pled not guilty in court and will continue to assert his innocence, I'm in the early stages of investigating this case, so any other comments would be premature, but certainly the public should be mindful that false allegations in cases such as this are not unusual. So even if you're talking about, I guess the range was...
I saw anywhere from 1.5% to 40-some percent. And
I saw like 15%. I think not unusual is a tough thing to quantify. And so again, I think to go into that in a whole lot more detail when it's not really quantified...
always happy to help you with the research there, and I think that we've got balanced research with what we do, and you know, even having additional comments, you know, any of us in the community would be happy to be able to provide you with a counterbalance to certainly a quote from their attorney. I think it's hard in those moments because the prosecutor's office will never make comment in these cases, primarily to one, shield the victim, and two, is it's the early stages of a case and they don't want to prejudice the outcome of it.
And Wendy, you were going to say what? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. So this is such a common problem. You know, I run a program at my law school called the Judicial Language Project, and we critique language in media and in law that is misleading or unfair or indulgent of unfair myths, in particular with regard to sex crimes cases. And this phrase, you know, it's not unusual as a declarative sentence, really is profoundly dangerous, I think. Whether the solution is to say other people disagree with that claim or just not to put it in, I'm not sure. But suffice it to say, the data is, it doesn't matter what the data is. It matters that the data of who makes false claims in court is overwhelmingly the case that people lie in criminal court all the time for money. In other words, it's insurance claims. People are more likely to report their own death than they are likely to report a false claim of rape. And, you know, it's so it's not just that this declaration is there, it's that we don't see any comments about whether false claims are common in other kinds of cases, even though they are, and this is not in dispute scientifically, they are far more common in other kinds of cases. So it's not a problem only in terms of juries reading that comment, and then they're going to sit in judgment in this case and say, oh, boy, I think I remember reading in a reputable newspaper that kids lie all the time in these kinds of cases, or that it's not unusual. That sticks in our collective consciousness when a claim like that is just left dangling. So my preference is to just keep it out. You know, who cares? It doesn't matter if it's usual or not usual. This case is entitled to be judged on its own. The fact that 12 other people may have lied in other cases does not reveal the truth in this case. If anything, it distracts the truth. That's why journalism shouldn't put stuff like that in these kinds of reports.
Any thoughts, Van or Evan on that?
I just think, sort of like Van said, the fact that the defense attorney was willing to give in an article of, I think about 1,000 words, he gave about a 25-word quote. I don't think it at all changes the perspective of the story. It just gives the attorney a chance to speak.
Yeah, what I like to, you know, usually defense attorneys do not speak on the record in the early stages of a case. So they'll speak in their filings in the motion stage when they start fighting back. Early coverage, the cases of early part, in the early stages of criminal proceedings, in my experience, always are stacked and biased in favor of the government. I'm reporting what the government's case is. The defense doesn't really have an ability to respond because it's just begun. So the accusations, the lawyers haven't even processed what evidence they're going to have to contend with. The fact that the attorney was willing to say anything, I felt I had a responsibility to report what he said.
Wait. No. This is the problem. Reporting anything a defense attorney says is so dangerous. Remember during the Kobe Bryant trial, the defense attorney said in public and in court, which is why reporters ran with it, something about the victim having sex with 3 men in 3 days. That became the storyline, even though it was absolutely false. The fact that a lawyer says something is not news. The strategic dumping of false information by the defense in criminal cases has led to tremendous injustice historically in this country, which is why reporters should be super skeptical of especially these big claims. Oh, it's not unusual. Well, you know, you can't just say that because the public thinks you wouldn't put it in there unless it were true. They don't understand it as a strategic statement from a defense attorney.
The difference is that there's a subjective and an objective statement there. We don't, for quotes, we fact-check every one of our stories, and not just the things that we write, but the quotes. So to the extent that there's a fact in a quotation, she was wearing a blue shirt, we will check that in the court record, make sure that's true, and if it's not, we won't use that quote. Our decision, and, I think it's the difference between the Kobe Bryant case and this quote, is that this is a subjective statement of a very general fact, which I think can be justified by the fact that this case is not unusual is general enough that it sounded like his subjective opinion on these kinds of cases, not a case where he said there are 2.6%, and in which case he would have checked that, and if it was not true, we wouldn't have.
But you know why he's wrong, and this is why you say you fact check, but I disagree with you. He may be correct that there are a certain number of false claims of all cases ever reported anywhere to anyone at any time. In terms of cases indicted, this is a bald-faced lie to say it's not unusual, because statistically, and the prosecutor's research on this has been done nationally over the course of many years with many, many different types of methodology, over 99%, I'll even give you 95%, let me be generous, over 95%, that's the best study for your purposes, 95% of charged cases are not false. So you're wrong to say it's not unusual if you're comparing charged cases only. And that's what you should be doing when you're doing comparative data analysis, because this case stands as a reporter's description of an offense where the vetting has already been done by law enforcement officials. There's been a forensic exam. There's been a decision to charge. The prosecutor can't ethically bring charges unless he or she believes he can prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. The amount of vetting that goes into the decision to charge is so significant that to say it's not unusual because some studies say some kids lie outside of the realm of having been vetted before formal charges are filed is very misleading, terribly unfair, and just, frankly, an untrue statement. And it's neither subjective nor objective. It's just false.
But I will suggest, reading this article, that it may be clear. I mean, they were quoting something here. They were not stating an objective fact, but they were quoting this thing. But when you say unusual, what you all are arguing is that the unusual can lead people to think that
that it's fact.
That's
right.
Fact.
Cases too. Look, instances like this, quotes like that. You know that a lot of these children. And we see 1,000 children a year at Baltimore Child Abuse Center. We're one of 800 child advocacy centers across the country. And the reason these models were created were to be able to enable a child in their own words to say what happened to them so no one could allege that someone's putting words in the kid's mouth or setting the kid up there. So we really try and have as forensically sound an investigation as possible with people who are trained in how to talk to these kids. The problem we end up finding, though, is that children end up recanting. They take back what they said because they see what happens to them. And one of our fears is an article like this can be used by the next perpetrator to show to a kid, look, if you tell someone that this happened, you're going to be in the paper. And all too often, it's just easy for kids to say, you know what, I don't want to go forward with this. You know,
How about this?
You and I know, the criminal justice system is no fun.
Why don't you say this? How about this? You're going to be in the paper and you're going to be a hero. Not you're going to be in the paper and people are going to think you're disgusting.
Yeah, but
people,
the defendant, the suspect, they're the one who says that first. So they're, you know, it's the that's at the even the earlier stage. The suspect saying to the victim, if you tell your mom, you're going to be in the paper, and that shuts it down early on.
That's not what kids are afraid of. They're afraid of their bunny getting killed. They're afraid of the mother getting killed. They're afraid of themselves getting killed.
No question about it.
When they tell. They get a different result. The data on making children come forward, the very little bit of data we have on whether children fare better or not when we compel them to testify and compel them to participate in the criminal justice system, those kids do better on average than the kids we shield and hide and protect. They do better with justice because it means people in important places of power believe them, listen to them, believe they were worth it. This is what we need to give to children. They have never gotten it in this country. They are disproportionately violated and disrespected because they don't vote, they don't have any money, and we have to stop using seemingly legitimate institutional forces like journalism to keep them quiet. We've got to bring them out, make them heroes, celebrate them, bring them into the courtrooms, let them be heard in their own voices, and stop with all the mythology about why they're not credible.
So, and this is, I think, where this began. This has been a very intense conversation and a good one. But and where it began was the critique by some members in the advocacy community to this article by writing letters to the city paper that they published on their website. And began this conversation. So. Let me bring it back to this before we can.
And we were split on this too. Lots of us in the advocacy community didn't want to respond at all because we didn't want to bring more attention to the issue of the child, et cetera. We felt it was important that there were certain global issues, which I think I appreciate all of us discussing here, came forward.
But you can both respond to this because Wendy and Adam, and then I'll close out and go back to Evan and Van, that Wendy, overall, you were not displeased with the article.
Oh, no. I thought the article was great. I loved it. And in fact, the only part I didn't like was the defense attorney making a false statement about false statements. And, you know, I try to be very provocative about this because I think social change comes with intentionally provocative conversation. So I know that I'm going to be an outlier to some extent when I make, and I teach about this all the time, but my pet peeve is when reporters and people talk about the oral rape of a child as, you know, the child performing oral sex, mm-hmm. because, number one, the child isn't a performer. Number
right.
two, it's not right. erotic and so
right.
forth. I only use that as an example because the reporters I teach say back to me, but that's the only way we can put it in without freaking people out as they're eating their cornflakes in the morning. And I say, The hell with them. The point is to get the truth out. You don't soft pedal war. You don't not talk about, you know, the brutal violence of a gang fight or what you know, since when are you worried about freaking people out over cornflakes?
And you, a little different view. About
we saw the global issue here, and I think that, you know, and as I said to everybody involved in this, we appreciate the fact that the conversation started, that these cases do need to be covered. But I want to be able to continue a dialogue and to see how we can perhaps cover them responsibly and effectively while maintaining some level of decency and dignity for these child victims there who, you know, Wendy and I may disagree on that point as to, you know, at what point they need to go public. But at this early stage, when the case is really fragile, you know, publicity one way or the other could make this case fall apart. And then that kid doesn't get that day in justice. And I think that, you know, we're gonna end up seeing what happens here.
And so Van Smith and Evan Serpik, I mean, so do you walk away from this with anything new?
I think it's definitely a helpful conversation and really helpful to hear, you know, the perspective of advocates. I think we will struggle with this. Every time a case like this comes up, we'll have the same kinds of conversations we had before this case. Always more information is better. I think, in the end of the day, I think we still did things the right way, to be honest. But it's definitely good to have more information, more to think about, and have more conversations.
Well, I want to just thank the four of you. First, I want to thank the folks from City Papers for being open and coming out to the public here with all of our listeners to kind of wrestle with this issue. Evan Serpik, who's editor of the City Paper, Baltimore City Paper. Van Smith, a senior staff writer for the Baltimore City Paper. I want to thank both of you so much. I appreciate you doing this. It means a lot to me as a fellow in this world of media and journalism to have you kind of stand up and be able to kind of thrash things out with people. Wendy Murphy, it's been great to have you on the air, adjunct professor of New England Law, Boston, and founder of Victim Advocacy and Research Group. It's good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
I appreciate taking the time. You added a great deal and were very, very provocative and thoughtful, as were you, Adam Rosenberg, executive director of Baltimore Child Abuse Center. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We have to take a very brief break. Yes, Ronnie Dice under me. Make It With You. He was born on this day for our day in history, and remember his great singing, his lovely love-making songs. Well, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, it's live with Chauncey Whitehead and Ms. Ernestine Shepherd about the one-year anniversary of their community walks, health in our community, pulling people together in that way. So stay with us. We'll be right back for the next part of our conversation to have you join it. Stay with us.